702. 702. On 92.7 and 106 FM. Streaming on 702.co.za, the 702 app, and on DSTV channel 856.
It's just gone 8 minutes past 6 o'clock. Welcome to it. It's the Monday edition then of The Money Show, which is of course brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Bring your Africanacity and contribute towards the Absa COVID-19 Social Relief Program. Visit absa.africa to donate today. Absa is a registered FSP. So it's been over 22 hours or so just since we've heard the President Cyril Ramaphosa announce that ban on alcohol trade as well. Then the effect on the country can certainly be attested to being quite massive as well, not just for consumers, but even for retailers, whether it be a restaurant, whether it be the National Liquor Traders as well, whether it be business overall also. So we'll unpack that and get into just what does it mean then overall for the local business fraternity and that aspect too. Also, we get to chat about what does it mean then for the industries in South Africa that suffer the most when it comes to this. Business leaders get to chat a little bit more. The CEO of the Sorbet Group gets to unpack the processes that are in place. Linda Sinclair will be chatting to us. And I made note of this one specifically because I happen to go to a sorbet as well. And that kind of just, the process has changed. Let me put it that way. It certainly has changed as to how things are done, and a whole host of precautions are certainly being put in place. Why does quantitative easing perhaps not work? And particularly for South Africa, we've had this discussion a lot. Just print money in order to help South Africa's debt problems. Why does that not work? Nazmira Mula has a few answers. She's from 91. We also talk about the TFG Group having bought Edcon's jet stores. What does that mean actually for Edcon and for the market as a whole? And can TFG actually turn that store around? We also have your business book feature as well as Make Money Mondays. And this evening, we have Dineo Moiketsi, presenter at V Entertainment. All that and more coming up in the next 2 hours. Do stay with us, of course. This is The Money Show.
702 for the curious
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Wendy Alberts is the CEO at the Restaurant Association of South Africa, and she joins us this evening. 22 hours since you've gotten the announcement that must have clearly shocked you and surprised the industry as a whole with regards to the ban of alcohol sales and distribution. You've had 22 hours to mull over it. What's the latest perhaps in the restaurant industry then, Wendy?
It was very disappointing news. You know, we've been working hand in hand with the government to look for workable solutions to rebuild the industry. Mm. And last night's news came without consultation, without any communication, without any warning. You know, we've been 5 weeks with the attorneys on the doorsteps of the tourism offices. We've been down to Patel's offices. We're back to Cocta, back to Patel, back to Cocta.
Yeah.
So it really has been very disappointing that government did not engage with us. And I think the hardest part for us is we've got three levels of restrictions that affected us. So one is obviously the liquor ban, which we're hoping for the liquor ban to have been lifted. Two, obviously, is the restriction on dining hours. And three, it obviously affects our takeaways and deliveries as well. So all round, it hasn't been great news for the restaurant sector.
Yeah. How big an impact does it have commercially, though, in the sense that restaurants are still open and can deliver per se with regards to delivering fast foods and the like as well, and even some people coming through to restaurants. But what does it mean for the restaurant industry? Is there a big suffering perhaps that will come through because now the alcohol portion has been taken out of those sales?
Look, absolutely, we were suffering already. You know, the whole 20 weeks have just been dismal for us.
Mm.
And how restaurants have traded through this time is commendable. I mean, I really admire their strength and their tenacity to keep their doors open. And we were really hoping for the alcohol to have allowed us to trade through the difficult times. So to give you an indication, we ran a survey that launched around about 2 o'clock today. We've had 300 responses. And of the 300 responses, 209 of those restaurants are going to be closing their doors until the restrictions are completely lifted.
Sure.
And out of the 290, we've got permanent closures, 69 permanent closures. So there's going to be a very small margin of restaurants to be able to keep their doors open. And what it means for permanent retrenchment on those numbers, so on the 300 restaurants approximately, we are looking at permanent retrenchments of around about 7,000 staff members. So the UIS is going to be impacted largely. And if you start adding those numbers up to thousands of restaurants, you can see how much pressure is going to be put on the financial system of the UIS.
Wendy, what is the Restaurants Association of South Africa going to do about this?
We absolutely have to guard our restaurants through this time. We're consulting currently with the council to take a lawsuit against the Liquor Board for non-performance and rebates in our liquor licenses. So we started out with around about 10,000 restaurants that were prepared to be in support of the rebates at an average of around about 7,000 rebate per restaurant. It's a substantial amount of money. But since then, we've had support from the various other industries. So we've got support from people like venues, guest houses, small hotels, movie theatres, entertainment centres, etc., who do have liquor licences. And that number could well creep up to around about 100,000 outlets that will be wanting a rebate back from government. So the pressure is now going to be put on government to certainly give these rebates back. And the pressure is now going to be put on government to support all the people that are unemployed. And I think the key thing when we talk about the unemployment is also not forgetting we've excluded waiters and waitresses out of that equation. Yeah. So it's a massive amount of people who are going to be resting on South African's unemployment arm.
Yeah. Wendy Albert, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. Giving us the latest there with regards to the restaurant industry. She's the CEO at the Restaurants Association of South Africa. Cass Kovadia, CEO at Business Unity. It's not business as usual. Of course, it hasn't been for quite some time. Does this hurt business and hurt things a whole lot more? Were you shocked, disappointed, and angered by the decision?
Look, it does obviously hurt business a great deal. I think I'm not too sure I was too shocked, because I think that the sort of news that has been coming from the healthcare sector and from government is that since the relaxation of the liquor sales ban, there's been an increase in trauma cases. Health workers have been saying that this has put pressure on health facilities to deal with COVID. So I think that this was in the air. I certainly did not expect government to ban liquor sales totally again. I thought that they would actually restrict the hours further of sales. So it does have a significant impact on the economy. As the CEO of the Restaurants Association has said, it will have an impact on jobs and put further pressure on UIF and so on.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, one has to acknowledge that it's an extremely tricky situation, because we're going into the peak. The next couple of months is going to put severe pressure on health facilities.
Yeah.
And we have to find ways and means, I think, and including the alcohol industry needs to sit down, and we all need to put our heads together to see how we can get people to be more responsible in the way they conduct themselves after taking alcohol, because that's the crux of the problem at the moment.
Yeah, what's Business Unity going to do then about this? Is this going to just remain? Are you guys okay to let this ban go in place? I mean, it's been just over 22 hours since that announcement was made with immediate effect.
So we will obviously discuss this. We're in ongoing discussion with government. Anyway, we've been in ongoing interaction with government during the entire COVID crisis.
Sure.
We will talk to them to understand exactly the rationale behind this decision, and we will see if we can put our heads together to try and manage this as best we can. And as I said, if we can somehow crack the alcohol abuse problem and try to work with government to ensure that there isn't a negative impact on already stretched health services, those are the sorts of discussions we need to have, I think.
Cass Kovadia, appreciate the time. Thank you so much. Business Unity South Africa CEO there joining us on the line to unpack the business side of things when it comes to that ban on alcohol sales and distribution. Lucky Ntimane then is the convener at the National Liquor Traders Council. Lucky, hurt, angered, disappointed by the decision made by the president yesterday?
Good evening, Arabid, and good evening to your listeners. So it's all of the above. We were caught blindsided by the government's decision, simply because we have been trying to reach out to them for the past 2 months. trying to engage with government so that we can sit down and have, you know, a solution that will be able to preserve health and also the livelihood of our people. But yeah, they never just listened. The only time that we heard from government again was yesterday when the announcement was made.
What do we need, though, to, and what, I mean, I'm sure you'd admit that we need to try and create a more responsible society when it comes to things like this, for example. We've had word from more than just the presidency or even government with regards to the irresponsibility that comes with alcohol and unfortunately all the other cases that it affects. But also health workers have continuously said that we've had an increase in the number of cases that aren't even just related to COVID-19 itself too, but also other things that are blocking out the healthcare system, unfortunately. How can we help the you know, consumers become a little bit more responsible when it comes to alcohol consumption?
The issue of alcohol abuse, it's an age-old problem that I think we as a country have avoided to deal with over the years. And it has caught up with us, but it caught up with us in the wrong time, you know, in the pandemic period. It's an issue that requires a behavioral shift with our consumers, you know, for them to be able to partake in alcohol responsibly. I mean, just in an example, Czechoslovakia, which drinks 10%, 10 times more than South Africa, but they don't have any issue of alcohol abuse there. So it's a behavioral shift that needs to happen. But, I mean, real solutions can be found in partnerships that needs to be had between government and the overall liquor industry.
What
and
do you
we
think,
believe that we can still achieve that.
Yeah, what do you think should have been done then in place of this? Let's just say you needed to implement some sort of stricter notion towards alcohol. What would you have preferred to have been done at this stage?
I think the industry should have been left to its own governance. I mean, the liquor industry has always been known to be high when it comes to the issue of self-regulation. We haven't had any issue with regards to any liquor trader who has transgressed COVID-19 regulation. So as far as the liquor traders are concerned, things have been running smoothly. The issue has always been the consumer, and that's an issue that we need to deal with head on.
Will you be joining the Restaurant Association and the likes, who perhaps will be trying to challenge the decision made by the president?
We will take guidance from our members on the ground. So we're still in consultative process, and we'll be able to make that announcement to the media in due course once we have concluded the process, as it were.
Lucky Ndimani, appreciate the time, but thank you so much. National Liquor Traders Council, national convener there, joining us on the line to have that discussion. The ban on alcohol sale and distribution, outside of just the tax collection situation that is going to certainly hurt South Africa, I think the other question we also need to ask is, what will government then do to try and prop up those liquor traders at a later stage, whether it be restaurants, whether it be alcohol associations, whether it be even just the traders of alcohol on a more grounded level? What happens then? Do we help prop up that sense of the economy as well? Do we then extend as well the National Guarantee Loan Scheme, which for me is a problem because it's a loan scheme. It's not necessarily help when you're loaning somebody money and still expect them to pay you back when business has already been tough anyway. Well, let's see how things fare on this front.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
All right, let's go straight into that market commentary. And it certainly has been an interesting market position, right? Earlier on, I was having a conversation really about where the market is going. It seems to not necessarily head in the same direction as the economy, perhaps two completely different things. Even in the US, you even have the NASDAQ gaining. Even today, despite everything, the all share went up more than 1%. Arthur Karras, portfolio manager at Macro Solutions, of Macro Solutions at Old Mutual Investment, joining us on the line. Arthur, thank you so much for the time. Where is this market going? Are we just going to keep going up and up? Has it let go of the negative notion of COVID-19 now?
The market is looking forward to the recovery. So what we've had in the last few months is the crash, or the correction, and the market is now looking through that and is saying that in the next 12 to 18 months, which is roughly where the kind of market looks into the future, things will be better than what they are now, and it's looking at the market through that lens, and hence the recovery that we've had.
In doing this recovery, though, is it, the question just becomes, I guess, around sustainability, and that would really be dependent on your crystal ball, I suppose. But it seems that there are a lot of stocks that just feel that the fundamentals are okay. They were coming from a very low base because the market was almost absolutely decimated around March or so. Are we going to see a, shall we say, medium-term sustained uptick? Are we back to the bull run, so to speak?
Well, the stocks that have done the best, if we look at the last 3 months, that would be the recovery, or pretty much the recovery at the bottom. The stocks that have done the best are the mining companies. That would be both the gold miners and the platinum miners and a number of the other mining companies. And that's partly because the lockdown in the platinum sector created a concern about a shortage of PGMs that was seen to have the potential to either balance out or even maintaining the deficit in that market, even with the drop in car sales that we were expecting. So that's helped those stocks along. We've also had that anybody that's involved in iron ore mining has done very well, because the demand in China has been okay, but Brazil has struggled to supply. So there's been a supply-side problem. So that's helped the iron ore miners along. And then in addition to that, too, a big part of our market is Naspers and Prosus. They're both up more than 25% in the last 3 months, and that's on the back of them tracking the rest of the tech sector, online area of the economy that's seen as going to benefit from the COVID environment, with people doing more and more of their lives online.
Mm. Are investors staying in the market, though? I mean, are they trying to rush back in and see that, okay, certainly things are back to normal, so to speak? It's just that, unfortunately, we've got this health crisis that's ticking things along. Are they back in?
Well, broadly, you'd expect investors to be back in, because there has been a correction. And over the last 2 years, we've seen the benefits of buying into weakness, buying into the dips. The buy the dip strategy is one that has worked. So people are trained to do that, so they have bought in. In addition to that, interest rates globally have fallen. So in South Africa, we're around 6 point something, but elsewhere in the world, you're lucky if you can earn anything from your bank deposits, and that pushes people into the market, where they're looking for a greater level of return, and they're forced to take on, whether they're likely or not, they're forced to take on a bit more risk if they do wish to earn more than zero.
16 rand, 69 cents against the US dollar. That's the current rand picture. That's certainly an improvement, isn't it?
Yes, it definitely is. I think the thing to bear in mind here is that the rand is not always performing relative to our own view of what's happening in South Africa. South Africa. So it's performing on a relative basis against other currencies. For example, one thing we know is that currencies tend to bottom post a loss of investment rating. It's like sell on the rumor and buy on the fact. So that is a part of what's happened now. A lot of the bad news that we've been expecting from South Africa is out there. We're potentially heading into an environment that would be a little bit better for emerging markets and developed markets, and the rand would be a beneficiary of that. It's one of the very tradable currencies in emerging markets, and it gets used by people to hedge, sometimes maybe in a bit of an inappropriate manner, but it gets used by people to hedge exposure to other emerging markets where there are less tradable currencies.
Mm. All right. TFG also then deciding, well, look, outside of just reporting a 43% decline in our sales figure in that trading update for the 3 months to 27 June, one other note that we're going to make is the little matter of buying Jet stores for 480 million. Your opinion, can they turn it around?
So there's a few things. It's very difficult to judge, whether a strategy like this is going to be successful. What we do know is that Bushini has got a very broad exposure to the South African retail sector, but most of it's focused on the middle end. And this, what this does, it gives them exposure to the lower end of the market, which Mr. Price and Pep, through Ackermans and Pep, have had pretty much to themselves for a long time. So by buying Jet, they get a big chunk of that market straight away in one go. So that definitely rounds up their portfolio, and it gives them access to the part of the market, the clothing market in South Africa, that's been growing the fastest. So all of those things are good. The other thing that when it becomes a key determinant in this kind of transaction is, what are you paying for it? And certainly the price sounds like it's come down a lot. from a few years ago when Edcon thought they could maybe get $10 billion for the company, including the debtors book. They now sold the company for around $500 million. That's for about half the stores, but it also includes $800 million worth of stock. So it sounds like a really good deal. They are taking on over $1 billion in leases, so there is exposure there that they're taking on. But this is one of the better parts of the Edcon group. It's generally seen as cleaner, with a better strategy, and you think that there's potentially better benefits and more attention, maybe than needing a complete turnaround, which is always a risky thing to try and get right.
Mm. Very quickly then as well, I mean, you still have Thank You, which is the loyalty rewards program that sort of kind of remains. What appetite do you think the market has for that?
I didn't quite get that.
Thank You, I mean, because, you know, Edcon is obviously split into that three segments. There was Edgar's, there's Jet, and of course the loyalty program, Thank You. What is the appetite market for taking up that loyalty program and perhaps putting it into, you know, whatever company that might be, for example, Woolworths, and perhaps trying to reward consumers and continuing that reward program? Is that something you think the market is still going to take on?
It would certainly be of interest to somebody. The reward programs are important because they give you data about your customers. And that's why the likes of Pick and Pay spent a lot of money and time to get their Pick and Pay shopper card that they got. And that's why Tix has had a head start for many years over some of its competitors because of the Tix card. So they know who you are. Mm. They know what you buy. They buy, know when you buy it. They know what stage of life you're at, depending on how you shop.
Data.
And that gives them a lot of information about you. So these things have got value because they give you data.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Look, it's certainly the model that Amazon has worked off, right? And look at the company that it's become. Arthur Karras, appreciate the time, though. Portfolio manager of Macro Solutions at Old Mutual Investment Group, joining us here on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Bring your Africanacity and contribute towards the Absa COVID-19 Social Relief Program. Visit absa.africa to donate today. Absa is a registered FSP.
This is Arabile Kumete, standing in for Bruce Whitfield on the next Money Show. Busisiwe Mavuso, CEO of Business Leadership South Africa, will be on how it works feature, should I say, as we look at the relationship between government and the business sector. There's the weekly Africa Business Report as well, and also Andy Rice, your marketing and branding with Heroes and Zeros.
702
for the curious
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
All right, so just last week I decided it was about time. I needed a haircut, so I went and got one. I also needed my nails buffed, shined, polished, all of those fancy nice things. I do that. Yes, I do. And it was really good. But I walked into a sorbet man and absolutely great service. But the other thing was that the regulations have clearly just changed. I needed to go through so much with regards to that screening process. How I was looked after that came through with, you can tell, a lot of attention to detail. Linda Sinclair, CEO of the Sorbet Group, thank you so much for your time. I can certainly attest to the difference in how things have certainly been for the business. How difficult has it been for yourself?
Hi, good evening. Yes, I think it has been a whirlwind over the last few months, but I do think that we have really worked very closely with our franchise partners to ensure that we have got a business that's still able to serve our guests, as you said, with the highest quality standards and strictest hygiene protocols in place. And when we were able to open our doors on the 23rd of June, once government gave us the go-ahead, which we were very excited about, to welcome our guests back in our salons, obviously with the strictest hygiene protocols in place.
Yeah, I mean, you do a lot of training for your staff just in general when it comes to, you know, things like haircuts, like manicures, like massages as well that happen across your sorbet range as well. How much training did you guys have to go through with regards to, you know, this situation as well, the COVID-19 regulations and how they've changed the business?
Yeah, I think, you know, training is integral to the success of the brand and to the operations, everyday operations of the business. You know, so the training protocols that we put in place were intense. You know, we spent 2 weeks training all of our citizens or our employees around the hygiene protocols. And then obviously we just had to adapt to what the government actually gazetted on the 19th of June before we could open on the 23rd. So there was lots of training being done. There were tests being completed by our citizens and our employees to make sure that they were really ready and ready to trade the minute we were able to open our doors with the hygiene protocols in place. And that will still remain as part of our operating processes moving forward and continued to obviously be looked at and be checked on an ongoing basis to ensure that compliance is adhered to.
Will there be perhaps a little bit more with regards to the testing being done on your on your staff as well? Will you continue to try and test them as much as possible?
Most definitely. All of our staff that on every shift are tested. Their temperatures are taken. You know, we obviously ask them the relevant questionnaires and the screening questionnaires done. And if there is any suspicion of anybody showing any symptoms, we send them home and we get them tested immediately. You know, the importance of our employees and our guests and making sure that they feel that they are safe in our environments is of the utmost importance to us trading during this time.
What does this mean, though, financially for the business? I mean, how much have you lost? How much are you set to perhaps lose continuously, I suppose, if business doesn't continuously pick up? I mean, you can imagine that there are some people who still have reservations on going to a sorbet in order to get, you know, whatever their treatment is.
Most definitely. I think, you know, we saw in the first week or 10 days that we were sufficiently busy and the demand was definitely there for treatments as well as for our retail products. Especially on the sorbet man side, and I know you mentioned that at the beginning when we started chatting, you know, men were definitely going out and getting haircuts, waxing nails, etc. was definitely in demand. We have seen that come off slightly over the past week. But that biggest impact has been on the fact that we've obviously got to adhere to social distancing, and we're also working with half the number of staff members at on any given shift because we are running a rotational shift basis to ensure that the hygiene protocols are in place and that social distancing is adhered to within our salons. So, you know, that has been the biggest impact, obviously, on our revenue. And we are obviously seeing that coming off slightly, but we are confident that once we get over this hurdle, there will definitely be continued demand for people who are wanting haircuts, facials, nails, etc. And that demand will continue moving forward, and we're there to serve our guests as best possible.
What about job losses, though, at a time like this? I mean, I can imagine it's difficult with regards to revenue, but keeping staff then in some of these places has been absolutely difficult, surely.
Yes, most definitely. I mean, we're obviously working, as I said, on a short-time shift rotational basis to ensure that we retain as many, many staff as possible. You know, our biggest focus right now is to work with our franchise partners to ensure that we provide them with whatever support they need to keep their doors open so that we can continue to employ as many of our employees and our therapists as possible. They are the backbone. They are the heartbeat of our business, you know, and they're the reason why our guests come in. It's to enjoy the wonderful treatments that they get from our therapists. So it's important that we retain our staff and we do what we can to keep our doors open, because without that, you know, we are going to be in very difficult times, and we need to make sure that we manage through that with our franchise partners.
Have you had to let go of any staff as yet?
So fortunately, because of the rotational shift basis, we have predominantly put them on short time or on a shift basis. So we haven't had to let go of many staff. And also where we've had one or two salons closed, we've been able to retain that staff within our other salons to support the shift and the rotational basis. So it's been fantastic that we've been able to retain as many staff as possible.
You don't have those numbers offhand by any chance, do you?
No, I don't have those numbers offhand.
No, all right. Then I suppose just very finally then, in terms of sort of moving forward now, you know, how best do you keep up with ensuring the safety of not just obviously your staff, which is absolutely critical, but also those that come through? How do you encourage them to continuously believe that, yes, they can actually stay or come through to a sorbet and indeed still feel safe?
Yeah, I think the biggest opportunity for us now is to ensure that we communicate the hygiene protocols to as many guests as possible, because I think there is a little bit of fear out there still, I mean, especially as the infection rate increases. So I think consistently demonstrating our hygiene protocols, communicating our hygiene protocols, and showing people that it is safe to come into the salons. You know, we've always complied with the strictest hygiene protocols as an industry. So, you know, the change is not that sufficient. You know, what you will experience is more PPE being put in place, but the lack of sanitization, sterilization, disinfecting was still there pre-COVID, and it's still there, obviously, just in a heightened form now while we're trading through these times. So it really is important for us to continually demonstrate and communicate the hygiene protocols that we have in place to welcome our guests back in a very safe environment.
Does the Sorbet Group have a breaking point? And I don't ask that tongue-in-cheek. I really just ask, you know, truly just, is there a point where you feel that as a group we may not be able to sustain ourselves anymore?
No, I don't think we do. I honestly think that, you know, the brand is strong. We're still seeing very good interest, obviously, and sufficient interest within the Sorbet brand moving forward from landlords, from potential buyers. So definitely not. I think, you know, the brand is strong. It has been around for the last 16 years, and we will continue to remain a force to be reckoned with within the beauty salon and the beauty industry moving forward.
Yeah. Linda, appreciate the time. All the best with it. Thank you so much for the time there. Linda Sinclair is the CEO at the Sorbet Group, having joined us on talking about how business leaders and COVID-19 are affecting and changing their business as well, and how that is going to be something that they'll continue to have to grapple with, unfortunately, not just for now, but certainly right through and into the future.
702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
As we head towards the top of the hour, let's talk about one subject that continues to rear its ugly head, unfortunately. The South African Reserve Bank continuously having to justify its position, I suppose, not just to common society, but also to political parties. And one of the other things that have certainly come up is, why not just print more money to help South Africa's debt situation? One, why did the South African Reserve Bank buy bonds on the secondary market and not necessarily straight from government? What does that actually mean? So why is quantitative easing, the perhaps continued buying of bonds from government and the printing of more money supposedly to push money into the system, not appropriate for South Africa? Nasmira Mula, head of South Africa Investments at 91, joins us on the line. Nasmira, thank you so much for the time. Do we just keep on shifting the goalpost? Because fiscal policy hasn't worked, so government has certainly failed in many of its instances, and now we're trying to go to the next best thing, the next thing that works perfectly fine, and that's fiscal policy, the South African Reserve Bank.
Good evening. Thanks for having me. I think the problem is we're in a crisis, and in a crisis, money is short, and people are looking for alternative solutions. So I can see why this solution has come up. Unfortunately, it doesn't really offer an option that South Africa can use at this point in time.
So what do we do from here then? Do we, you know, do we just say that no, it definitely isn't appropriate for South Africa? And if it isn't, why isn't it?
So in a crisis, there's a legitimate case to be made that you could fill a short-term one-year funding gap with a central bank buying bonds. Unfortunately, in South Africa's case, we don't have a one-year funding gap. We have a multi-year funding gap because we have expenditure that is at a level that is unsustainable, and we have revenues in the form of tax revenues where growth has perpetually disappointed. So this was 2008. If we were in 2008, situation where we'd run surpluses for several years, and we were in a situation facing the current funding gap, I think there would be a legitimate case to be made that we could consider something like the Reserve Bank directly financing the Treasury in terms of quantitative easing.
Yeah, the question also becomes, I mean, how much would we do? And as you said, the funding gap is multi-year, right? So that really means that it really could go into the trillions in terms of how much we'd need to help government here.
And also, I think there are plenty of examples of countries around the world where you have this multi-year funding gap, which then quickly results in a situation where you have the currency perpetually weakening, where you have inflation heading higher because you have this perpetual increase in the money supply year after year. And that's the risk that we have. Argentina, Venezuela, Zimbabwe closer to home as examples of why a multi-year funding gap is not something that can be financed by a Reserve Bank printing money.
So
it would only work if this was a single-year problem that the central bank could step in to fill the gap, and that's not where South Africa is at this point in time.
Yeah.
Our expenditure is too high and our growth is too low.
So what do we do then? What's the solution here? I mean, we've highlighted the problem. We've highlighted that we can't use quantitative easing. What can we use? What methods are available to us?
We have to do the hard stuff, unfortunately. We need to cut expenditure. And actually, what Peter Mboweni's proposed in the budget is not even really a cut in expenditure. It's just a much slower growth rate in expenditure from what we've seen previously. And let me give you a scary stat for tonight.
Mm.
In the current fiscal year, given the fall in tax revenues, public sector wages will account for 60% of all tax revenue collected. So 60% of tax revenues will be used to pay the salaries of 2.5% of the population in South Africa.
Sure.
So that begins to focus the mind in terms of how we need to think about this. We have expenditures running too high for the current tax base. That's the first problem. The second thing is the government needs to get growth going, which means that instead of these long lists of plans, they need to prioritize a few key reforms and actually get them done. And that is what has been sorely lacking. There hasn't been execution in any of the reforms suggested for a very long time.
Mm. And it seems that, you know, the more we have this discussion, the more people keep bringing it up and just saying, well, it should be a civic duty that the Reserve Bank just gets involved in here. And yet we keep saying that the reforms that should have been done a long time ago should have been done and aren't done. And that is actually where the massive gap certainly is. Do you think there's now finally perhaps the political will to get those reforms done? It seems the president has spoken about them. The finance minister has continuously spoken about them. Even the Reserve Bank governor has said that if those reforms aren't in place, we aren't going to get anywhere.
I would hope so. I would hope that we finally reach the point of actual execution. But we're 4 months into this crisis and there is no visibility yet on execution. We're still talking about it and not doing it.
Mm. Do you think the budget perhaps helped in any way?
I think the budget really focused the mind, because when you start to look at those numbers and realize where the debt to GDP ratio is going without any intervention in the form of reforms, without any attempt to curb expenditure and increase growth,
yeah,
it starts to look pretty scary. So I think it's focused the mind, but whether we can translate that into execution is something I'm hoping for. I just haven't seen evidence of so far.
Yep, it certainly has been the problem for the longest time. We talk and unfortunately don't get things done. Nasmira Mulla, appreciate the time, head of SA Investments at 91, joining us on the line there.
702 on 92.7
and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za, the 702 app, and on DSTV channel 856.
It's 8 minutes after 7 o'clock. The Money Show is, of course, brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Bring your African asset and contribute towards the Absa COVID-19 Social Relief Program. Visit absa.africa to donate today. Absa is a registered FSP. My name is Arabile Kumeto, of course, standing in for Bruce Whitfield. I'll continue to give you the latest then on the show. Just some more news, I suppose, on the economic front as well. We did see Business for South Africa give a thumbs up to Finance Minister Tito Mboweni, who had claimed and wanted South Africa to go into a zero-based budgeting system, which would ultimately mean that every expenditure item needs to actually then be motivated for, and that only growth-enhancing measures would actually be agreed to for the budget, and you'd have to actually justify exactly why each item would need to be put forward. So Business for South Africa agreeing to it and saying that that actually is the way things should be going. And if anything, actually, that is going to help our growth picture. They believe that growth is certainly going to decline this year by around 10% or so, and could actually go up around 5% in 2021 and then 6% in 2022. So some optimistic numbers there, because that could certainly claw back a lot of the unemployment and the jobs that would have been lost, particularly this year as well. So it certainly gets interesting from here on. Will we get that zero-based budgeting? I believe it's a very lengthy process, though. So I don't think it will be done by the time we get to February's budget next year. But the medium-term budget policy statement, which does then also come together in October, will hopefully give us a little bit more word on that. But in this hour, though, we will be talking about the purchase by the Foschini Group of Edcon's Jet Stores. We also have your business book feature, as well as Make Money Mondays. Tonight, we have Dineo Moiketsi.
702 for the curious. On 92.7 and 106 FM.
On the face of it, the deal looks like Edcon loses quite a bit, around 800 million rand that they have sort of in assets that should have actually been going to investors in many ways, in particular here. 480 million rand, though, is the purchase price. Evan Walker, portfolio manager at 361 Asset Management. This deal seems too good to have been passed up by the TFG Group anyway.
Hi, good evening. Yes, it does. It seems like a very good deal for TFG at face value. I mean, obviously, we know it's difficult times they're purchasing this in, but you know, it seems like a very, very lucrative acquisition for them.
Mm. Would you suggest that now is perhaps the time that they can turn this business around? They can sort of rejig and change things because things are down anyway, and work them in so that they fit into the rest of the brands they have?
Yeah, I think it's an opportune time because I think at this period, I mean, obviously buying something out of semi-liquidation, you're able to pick the assets that you want for this business. So I think the starting point for them is they were able to pick the stores that they actually wanted to take on. And that's a huge benefit for any business. I mean, you know, getting rid of a lot of stores in this process, mm-hmm. and I think that starts them off in a far better stead than if they bought the business 18 months or 24 months ago when they would have had to take the entire leasehold spectrum on board. So this allows them, the opportunity allows them to pick the assets which they want for their business. And certainly they would have been very circumspect around choosing the store base. They know obviously the South African landscape very well. Mm. And they would have chosen their store base very carefully in terms of the next 5-year projections on those stores.
Yeah, there's. It does come with 370 odd retail stores. There's distribution centers, a few properties as well that come to mind here. So a lot for them really to get out of this. But why did TFG necessarily say yes? Actually, let's take on Jet.
I think it goes to the management team of TFG. I think they've been quite acquisitive. They've made a number of acquisitions globally. I mean, they've looked at the South African base, obviously over time, and that it hasn't. Now, that hasn't obviously given the opportune set to make acquisitions domestically, but I mean, they're quite an aggressive management team at TFG. So I think it starts with the management team and then heads downwards. I think it's still a young management team that wants to grow this business quite substantially. I think they're obviously coming to the market to raise capital for their growth phase and just to obviously support their business through tough times in South Africa. But I certainly think it does start with the management of TFG. And obviously, this is an opportune time for someone to look at an acquisition in a tough market like we're experiencing.
Mm. Does it fit? Does Jet fit?
Yeah, I think it does fit. I think Jet's a very good business. It's a standalone business in the Edcon stable that always had value. It's in that value segment of the market, which I think naturally over time, and we're going to experience a tough economic climate, way tougher than we were experiencing pre-COVID. So you know, I think this is a business that will fit very well. I think this is a business that they can streamline, and I think the separation process in the Edcon Group has already been semi-completed. I think that's going to be the tough part for them in the next 24 months is obviously streamlining that into the TFG business. But I mean, it's a, you know, TFG is a business that the Foschini Group's been around a long time, and it's got a lot of processes internally, which obviously Jet can link into. So I think it does fit, but it's got a separate business, obviously, Jet, and it's up to them to run it. But it's, you know, everything we've seen and heard is that the Jet team is certainly able to continue with their current processes.
Yeah, hopefully, of course, the saving of jobs is going to be the critical part, and that's ultimately what we're trying to get at. That's what the business rescue process is supposed to try and do. They've certainly done a good job here. This is a clear example of a business rescue that can work, right?
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, unfortunately, there's still going to be a lot of store closures in this process. I mean, the business rescue process, as we said, doesn't allow them to cherry pick. There's still going to be, unfortunately, a lot of job losses, but way more than if this business had gone into liquidation or there hadn't been a preferential buyer. So I certainly think if we do see some turnaround in the SA economy over the next 3 years, this business can expand off the base again and hopefully employ people back to where it was before. But, you know, it does obviously allow us to still retain a very good brand in the South African market. I think it's justified to be here. And it does support a lot of jobs, which we fortunately can't lose anymore, you know. So this is an environment where every job is sacrosanct.
There's still thank you, though, the loyalty program that gets left behind at this point in time. Do you think that still has some sort of interest? Do you think there'll definitely be offers for that as well?
I'm not sure at this stage I think there's still going to be offers for different parts of the business. How the balance of the business gets split up. I mean, we've already seen, you know, some of the actual Edgar's businesses. We've seen the offer for those. We haven't seen the exact details of those come through yet.
Yeah.
So certainly there are parts of this business that are still available. I mean, it's got a substantial customer footprint, this Edcon Group. So yes, there could still be parts that are value accretive to, you know, the pre-existing Edcon stakeholders.
We'll get interesting, actually, from that front, particularly once you start looking at all the other parts and how exactly this thing gets unfortunately torn apart, really, which is exactly what they're trying to do. Just very quickly as well on the retail space overall, and, you know, one can talk clothing retail, but I suppose all of retail is really struggling at the moment.
We went into, you know, we started the year in a very tough economy. I mean, we started the year in what we saw was a very over-traded environment, unfortunately, South Africa. I mean, the retailers, in fairness, and predominantly the property and the landlords had railed out a lot of space over the last 5 years. So the store development program had been, you know, we thought it had been in excess for the South African environment to start with. So we came into the year in what was a very lackluster economy, and obviously that's been hugely exacerbated now with what we've seen globally. You know, we've seen these retailers, we've seen the Mr. Prices and the TFGs come out to raise capital. We're probably going to see more of that. We've seen, obviously, PEP do the same. So certainly, I think there's going to be more capital raises to support these businesses, but these businesses are going to have to now streamline them to operations that are going to be coincide with a very tough economy. So I think net-net, we're going to see them obviously go back to a lot of the landlords in terms of their rental agreements and back to a lot of these underperforming shopping centres and close those stores, unfortunately. So it's going to be a period of shrinkage and consolidation in the South African market. It's something that I think, unfortunately, they had to come irrespective of COVID. It was actually a necessity regardless of this current pandemic. So unfortunately, it was a state of play that needed to conspire. And Edcon being the weak balance sheet culprit in this process, being the first one to fall, but it's a natural process in any evolution of any business or industry, and I certainly think that hopefully ultimately if you see this consolidation that all the players, the existing players in South Africa, come out stronger in the next 3 years if the economy does improve, but the consolidation will be helping.
This also means, you know, as you made note of then, somewhat related, of course, is the property counters also get a hit as well then. As investors, you probably look at the likes of Growth Point, I mean, Into Prop as well, of course, having struggled for quite some time. That was just the straw that hit the camel's back then, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, I mean, we look at all these companies. I mean, as investors in the JSC, I mean, there's not a single company we don't look at. I mean, we're still struggling to price the equity of most of these property companies. I mean, I think they've been through the worst and people are back and are paying rental, but, you know, it's going to be tough negotiations, I think, over the next 36 months for most of these property companies as their clients struggle to see and the rationalization that you're going to come, you know, not only from a change in work environment and people working at home is going to be, I think, quite a substantial shrinkage in office space, which is going to exacerbate a lot of these counters as well. So, you know, it's a very tough space for us to price equity in at this point in time.
It just gets harder and harder. All right. Well, appreciate the time. Evan Walker, Portfolio Manager at 361 Asset Management, the TFG, the Fashini Group, that is, buying Edcon's Jet Stores, its brand, the stores that range around there as well, 371 odd stores as well as the brand, 800 million rand or so in stock as well, will be subject to this entire deal. So many parts of Edcon being torn out of this, but it's all in a bid to at least continue to save as many jobs as possible and keep the business running in whatever format possible as well.
The Money Show.
Business Books.
All right, so we get into our business book feature now. Of course, Ian Mann joining us this evening, regular book reviewer and MD at Gateways Business Consult. Ian, your book this evening, Questions Are the Answer, A Breakthrough Approach, as well into by Catmull there. It's a forward book as well, isn't it? So a really interesting one here. What is it actually about?
Well, I think that just to put in perspective, the authors are, one teaches at MIT and the other one is a co-founder of Pixar. Pixar is probably the most creative movie-making machine the world's ever come across. Mm. So you've got two people who really are concerned about how leadership and businesses can work better, and they've got really good backup from personal experiences. The thing is this, Peter Drucker said that there are few things as useless, if not dangerous, as giving the right answers for the wrong questions. And I think that in an environment now where we don't know we don't know the answers, we've got to really get very, very good at identifying what questions are, as opposed to plugging along and trying to give answers to things that probably shouldn't have been done in the first place. Possibly the most important skill that a leader can have today is the ability to get people to ask better questions. And it's very interesting. The authors talk about having been at a conference, and they're talking to these executives. They were saying that the most important thing a leader can do today is to be the catalyst that causes questions to be asked and to keep asking better questions. He said at the end of his talk, a man stood up and said, I was promoted to a CEO only because I was always at every level of my career the guy who had all the answers. And now you're telling me that my answers aren't important. I've got to ask good questions. He says, I don't know how. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very profound thought, because a lot of people are faced with that. We're not sure what to do. It's too hard. And we turn to the CEO, the executive, and presume that they're going to have all the answers for us. And they can't and they shouldn't have. So I think that this book is very, very timely, because it leads us in the correct direction. Einstein said that if he had a life-threatening problem, and he had an existential, and he had only 1 hour to solve that problem, he said he would spend the first 55 minutes of his hour working out what the correct question was. He said, if I've got the correct question, yeah, I'll be easily able to answer the problem in 5 minutes. Mm. So I think we need to start thinking in terms of asking questions, as opposed to seeing a problem and coming up immediately with an answer. And that's what the book is about.
Sure. I mean, even the likes of, you make note as well here, of, you know, the likes of Jeff Bezos, know, his approach to any problem solving really has been able to fuel Amazon's exponential growth, of course, and he really based it around getting the right question is key to getting the right answer. Making note of that again, as you say, being a very critical response to getting businesses ahead, even in this time.
And I think that the this is the time when we need it most. The book came out recently, so it obviously was written way before the pandemic. The Professor Gregerson has been teaching this style of thinking at MIT for a while already. And what he's done in this book, why this book is useful, is he comes up with all those basic ideas and basic methodologies that you can use, very accessible. Very few of them are absolutely mind-blowing, but very accessible ways in which you can cause questions to be asked around you. I'll just give you one quick idea. We very often have brainstorming sessions when we're faced with a problem. we get together and we all brainstorm, how can we come up with the best answer?
Yeah.
He's got a different form of brainstorming. He calls it the question burst. What he says is, you want to get people to come up with good questions, not good answers. So you get your team together, try and find people who in the company who are different, that you can get into your question burst brainstorming session. He says, what you need to do is, firstly, you've got to find a question that challenges you to do it. I think a question that everybody's challenged with.
Yeah.
Prevent the company from hurting the very people who helped build it. And if you put a question like that, for example, you get people into a group, small group, definitely people with different angles on things. So you don't sit with exactly the same people who tell you exactly the same answer. People with different approaches to things. He says step number one is explain the question, explain the what you're dealing with as briefly as you can. He says don't elaborate. He says take 2 minutes doing this, because elaborate but direct people towards giving particular answers. Quickly give an explanation, and you ask for questions only. No explanations, no preambles, nothing. And then put a timer on it for 4 minutes. Get the group to come up with 20 questions, if they can, in 4 minutes. It's a time constraint, because people don't do anything other than come up with questions. At the end of that one. What you do, you would have recorded all the questions. And then what you do is, you on your own, sit down and look for the really good ones that intrigue you, and see how you could unpack them. So it's an excellent idea for trying to get out problems that you have by getting the questions right. So that's one of the techniques he uses.
Sure. Okay, and we certainly are struggling, unfortunately, with the line this evening as well, which seemingly continues to cut. But certainly such an interesting book to continuously be able to read as well. That is there. So we'll leave it there, unfortunately. Our business book feature, okay. Questions Are the Answer, a breakthrough approach to the most vexing problems at work and in life. It's a book then by Hal Gregerson and Ed Catmull as well, then as a part of that book. Really just asking, are you putting in the right questions, perhaps? Questions are the answer. So perhaps you should start looking at that instead, and not necessarily just going straight into finding answers for things that you haven't actually found the right answers for as yet. So that becomes interesting at this point. So, so good to get that one as well.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Bring your Africanacity and contribute towards the Absa COVID-19 Social Relief Program. Visit absa.africa to donate today. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show.
Make Money Mondays.
So we have our Make Money Mondays guest on the line, of course, today. As usual on a Monday, we get to unpack just somebody's journey, somebody popularly known, of course, somebody's journey with money and just how they've sort of interacted with money as they've grown up. And what does it do now? How does it feel to sort of have it or not have it? And what are the challenges that have certainly been faced in and around that travel journey when it comes to money, economics, finance, all of that and all of those elements. So this evening, we're lucky enough to be joined on the line then by Dineo Moiketsi, who is, of course, an actor, an actress, singer, voiceover artist, MC, presenter, you name it. Multi-talented, or as they like to say now, the multi-talented Dineo Moiketsi. Thank you so much for the time. Dineo, actually, please, would you correct me? Is it Dineo Moiketsi, or have you officially changed it to Lang?
I've officially changed it to Lang.
Congratulations.
So the older people would say you're disrespecting the cow.
Certainly, exactly. So I'm so sorry. I'm deeply, deeply sorry. Please tell Solo I apologize quite profusely for that. Dineo Langa joining us then, of course, as well. Thank you so, so much for the time. I hope you're keeping safe and the family as well.
100%. We're doing all that we can to evade this pandemic.
Yeah. Look, it certainly does get very difficult and very rough at a time like this as well. We're going to, of course, unpack your money journey. And, you know, it can get a little bit difficult because you have to admit certain truths to yourself and think, oh, man, I didn't necessarily spend money that well here and there. But, you know, we'll start it off, yep. I suppose, very lightly. And I suppose start right at the beginning. Your first interactions, shall we call it, with money and how that was really back in the day. And when was that?
My first interactions with money, I think I was in my teens. My mother decided that I deserved an allowance. This was, of course, on top of tuck money that my great-grandmother was giving me.
Did they both know about this, though? Did they know that one was giving you tuck money?
Yes, they did.
You know how it can get.
I know how it can get, but I was the first great-grandchild, so I was spoiled with everything.
Oh, boy. All right. And if that continued, so you continue to get that as sort of the first, you know, array of money that you got then, how would you actually spend that? I mean, was it just a case of, you know, spend at will? Were there words that came with it, words of advice, thoughts, you know, all of those notions as well?
You know, it was to assist with things like, I guess, toiletries and when I started buying magazines. So I think my mother was cultivating my interest and my coming into my own and discovering the world as a teenager. But the one thing I will say is that my great-grandmother constantly encouraged the culture of saving. You know, she was a huge, huge saver. And with every bit of money that would come in from my mother, she'd always say, you must try and save your money. Don't go buying food. Sure. Don't go buying all the stuff. You don't need it. But also then I'd slightly take advantage of being the favorite. When all that money is run out, I'd then ask for more from my great-grandmother because I knew she had a soft spot for me.
Why wouldn't you? Look, it's also savings month, Dineo, right? So you actually speak about that topic and it actually is the right month to be speaking about it. How's that savings journey, though, going? Has that been something that you've taken on from that young age to perhaps be able to do even better now? Or, you know, is it still, you know, very difficult to do?
You know what? I'll say a bit of both. It's still slightly difficult to do, but as you grow up, you realize that you need to. I think working in the industry that I do, funny story, the fine print of being part of the entertainment industry is really becoming money savvy and understanding finances. And unfortunately, some of us learn by putting our hands in the fire.
Ooh, and nobody tells by you, taking right? Certain,
nobody at all says to you, listen, just because you've got this lump sum right now, try your best to just keep 25% of it aside. You know, you never know what's going to happen. Or the likes of policies, you know, because we're not in formal structures. So things like medical aid or policies or investments, you don't actually get into that until very much later into your life. So I will say that I'm becoming much better at saving, but I am still slightly impulsive when it comes to luxury items.
Look, you certainly aren't alone. Look, you know, one thing's for sure is that there are a lot of us who sort of look at it and just think, oh man, I promise just that, I don't know what item it is that you have, but I have an affinity for watches, for example. And I'm always just just that one watch. I promise after that I'll be fine. I promise. And then, yeah, two watches later, I'm sitting there thinking, oh, what have I done? What was it that perhaps made you feel like, you know, it was the time to get your money in order, though? Was there a particular event that occurred?
Oh, boy. Wanting to acquire assets. That's what sort of put the boot in my caboose, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because it really did become a, yes, we love shopping. Yes, we love looking good. But what does the future look like? What level of comfort am I looking for?
Yeah.
What opportunity is there in treating my money a lot better than what I do?
Sure. What was your first job then, Dineo?
Oh, gosh. This is when when I heard that this question was going to come up.
Look, I was a waiter, so I did the normal stuff. I was just a waiter. I washed cars, you know, so I don't know if that helps in trying to ease your...
No, it does help. Look, there's the thing is, I was also a waiter. It's just, at what age was I a waiter?
Oh, no, look, so don't get it wrong. I was a waiter from the age of 15 And yes, a lot of us.
Oh, great!
Call it,
then
call
we're
it...
in the same boat.
Oh boy! Look, it was rough. So those restaurants are unforgiving.
Oh, it's hardcore.
Right?
They don't care about your feelings.
And for how long? I mean, was it just during the school holidays, or was it something that you then had to do during the weekends? And why did you need to do it? I mean, if you were getting sort of tuck money and perhaps an allowance as well, did you feel the need to do it because of independence, or was it just really your own desire to, you know, want to, or was it a push even from the parents?
Okay, so my life took a twist. And sorry, this might take a bit of a dark turn. I lost my great-grandmother at 15. Mm. So I moved up because I grew up in Spring, Guatemala.
Yes.
And so then I moved up to being a boarder at the National School of the Arts. Now, it's my first time in boarding school. I have to manage money. I'm not getting tuck money and an allowance. So out of this allowance, I must create provision for tap money. I must create provision for toiletries and also the small little things that I love, and also takeout that you want to eat with your friends there's a KFC nearby, there's a Debonair's nearby, you know. So, you know, as a kid, and when you're thrust into that sort of money management space, you're constantly thrown in the deep end, because come the middle of the month, you're calling your parents going, "Hey guys, how are you?
Yeah.
Can I have some money?"
And the first question is, what do you want?
It is always, what do you want? And then the question after that is, what did you do with the money that we sent you? Which is tough, because you can't really account for it, because you're not even keeping tabs of, okay, how many magazines did I buy?
Sure.
How much of this did I buy? And now also as a teenager, you started buying lip gloss
and
eyeliner.
Oh, yes.
So there's these little added things that are throwing off your tiny budget. Sure. But you can't help it, because it's the cool thing.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to find other means to perhaps try to supplement it. And, you know, getting a proper job actually is one of the things that you kind of get into. Did that then pour you into things like getting a bank account immediately? Or was that something you've always had for some time? I mean, because obviously that creates a sense of money savviness, so to speak.
Well, you know, my mom was the smart money savvy person with regard to this question, because my mother opened up a bank account for me when I was 12.
So she was ready for you to go to work already at that point, I suppose, then, right?
Pretty much. Like, you can breathe, you can smile, get in there.
Only thing missing is an ID and tax number, and we're good to go.
Exactly. Exactly. So that was there for quite some time, but I didn't have access to it until I was a boarder.
Oh, okay. So some discipline, I suppose, being brought into the mix here.
Oh, but it made me miserable, because I wanted all of the money now, and I wanted to buy everything I desired. My mother still maintains I need to start a clothing brand because of how much I love clothes. It was my kryptonite in high school, and it's still my kryptonite to this day.
I think let's talk about that and a whole lot more right after the short ad break. We're talking to Dineo Langa, actress, presenter, voiceover artist, MC, everything you can think of, really, as we unpack her money journey, with us this evening. It is our Make Money Mondays. Back after this.
The Money Show. Make Money Mondays.
Let's continue then with our Make Money Mondays guest. This evening we have Dineo Langa, of course, who joins us then, actress, presenter, MC, voiceover artist, you name it. Can we add business owner or some sort of business acumen as well to that list, Dineo?
Yes, you can. My husband and I own a production company called Langa Enterprise Hub Together.
That's great.
Started last year.
Yeah. So how's that been? I mean, obviously having to, whether it be planned finances around starting the business, keeping the business going, and growing it as much as possible, that has certainly been quite difficult outside of COVID-19 on its own then as well.
It's been a hurricane. Lots of, you know, lessons in the moment as you are going through the fire. Literally baptism by fire. That's the best way I can put it. You know, but it's one of the best experiences because I can appreciate the business acumen that my husband brings to the business. He has a lot of instincts that I personally don't have, and whatever, you know, he doesn't have, I have. So we balance out each other out quite nicely. We still have a lot more to learn, and we have a way to go. But I also appreciate how we sit down and highlight to each other our dream projects. Say, you know, this is the type of project I would like to do within this time. And we sort of get into a think tank about how best to execute that.
Yeah, certainly would. I mean, it's very helpful, right? Being able to go through that journey, as you say, then together and making that investment together is, I mean, it's a big decision as a family to, you know, go into something, whether it be together or not, actually. But the fact that there is a business in mind, the learnings and the teachings that you both have to then go through. How often do you feel you guys get into, you know, a situation where you have to ask yourselves whether we'll be able to fund this business continuously and try to develop and grow it beyond where it sits right now?
You know, I'll be honest to say, with the pandemic, it's a regular conversation. But the one thing I can appreciate about being a creative is that there is a persistence to you. All those levels of rejection don't compare to a global pandemic, but it sort of preps you to not throw in the towel so easy, to dig deep within yourself and sit there and say, okay, how do we get around this? How best do we move our mission forward, even though it won't be dressed in the same way we had imagined?
Yeah.
But, you know, how do we find ourselves in a position where, at the very least, we've created a foundation for what we want to do. So, I mean, we have the conversation regularly, but the one thing I will say is that there's no conviction towards, let's call it a day, at least we tried.
Yeah. That's certainly a good testament to actually be born with, I suppose, in this moment as well, because COVID-19 can really be quite discerning as well and cut really deep. Your first investment, if you want to call it that, what was yours?
My first investment.
Yeah, no matter what it may be.
That's a tiny. Because I guess, that one came before that one. You know,
you can tell them about all of them, actually.
No. Then they'll say I'm extremely pompous. All the callers of 702 will call in and say, that girl is pompous. She must never come back. At some point, a friend of a friend said to me, you know, they have a really good broker and they believe that it's something that I'd be interested in based on the conversations that we've had. So nervous as I was, I took the meeting with the broker, and I started very small. And he said, look, we can create just a few investments that are conservative for you, and we'll see how it goes from there. And that's what we did. And now he's, well, not now, last year before everything crumbled, last year he said, it's time to just push things up a bit more and invest in a bit more. I'm not going to go any further than that.
I'm trying to eke as much out of you as possible on that one. Okay.
I know.
Here's one that I will try and eke a lot more out of you on then. The clothing brand or the opening of that. What are your thoughts around doing it or not doing it then as well? And what, you know, why wouldn't you? Why could you as well at a time like this?
You're so terrible. There are definitely conversations around it. There are definitely strategies that are being put together so that can come to life. You know, you realize that you can love something, but, you know, the nitty gritty of it is very Sure. It's very intricate. You know, there's many components that need to come together to make it happen.
I
find we're living in a beautiful era where the Ladumas are being put on a pedestal, where we have a rich Mnisi, who will be defended till the cows come home about his pricing. You can't sort of misstep walking into that world. You have to research. You have to find the right team to support you in your endeavor to be in that business. So that's where I am. I am at beginner level. I have decided on how I'd like to start.
Yeah.
But then comes, you know, funding it, which is another monster altogether.
The bravado that comes with it all is certainly also, you know, one element, right? I mean, just to have the thought process is enough, but now to have the bravado to actually step up and actually do that. Have you found that you're at least developing that a whole lot more as well as you not necessarily only just grow older, but even just look at business differently?
It ebbs and flows. Some days I am all in with the greatest gumption. And on other days, I am scared and shaking in my boots because I'm just like, how's it going to happen?
Yeah.
How's it going to work? Is this the right thing to do? And you do question yourself, you know, because inherently the world does go, how dare you? Who do you think you are? Yeah. And by forging ahead, you're saying, I am every bit the woman I think I am. I am every bit the businesswoman I think I am. And here's my product.
Sure. Well, all the best with it. I know I'll be looking out for it. You can guarantee that much. Before we close things off, though, I have to ask the sneaky questions, right? So your biggest extravagance, something you just continuously spend on, and even though you're not supposed to, you just continue to do it, unfortunately, because it just is what it is.
I'm so glad my husband is not listening right now.
Well, we'll send him the podcast, I promise.
Please don't. Please do not sabotage me right now. shoes. Luxury shoes.
Are there that many?
Yes.
Oh boy. Okay. Let's name the top three. Let's get into just the top three at the very least then.
Oh boy. There are various. I'll just say one.
Okay.
I'll say one brand. I have various types of. Oh, I want to whisper it because it sounds so obnoxious.
You'd be surprised at how many people you share that with, actually. And I think this is the whole point of this discussion as well, then, right? And you know, before we get into what it is the realization, I think, for every other person who's listening right now is that it doesn't matter who you are, but the things we all want are all there. We all want either the basics or the high-end stuff, all because it's just human nature. It's what we actually desire, you know. So I think that's the whole point of this, to try and just make people understand as well that they're not the only ones who either struggle or get their money journey right. They all have to sort of find their own route and their own way.
Yeah, you're right.
So now you're going to tell us?
Okay, well, I'll tell you.
Okay, you tell me, yes.
I have various pairs of Christian Louboutin.
Okay. So does it have to be, it's various pairs, as you said, right? So they don't look the same. They're not all identical. Yes. Because I only know of one pair that a lot of people would probably like. It's the all black one with just the red bottom. And then I'm just like, I don't understand the difference.
That's the 120 millimeter Spokate.
I almost thought you were going to say 120 million rand. All right. Do you know?
No.
It's been absolutely great chatting to you. Thank you so, so much for the time
thank
this
you
evening.
So much.
Really, really appreciate it. I hope this helps other people as well. The money journey is not an easy one, but one that is shared by many people and comes in various and different forms as well. So we thank you so, so much for your time. We don't take it lightly. All the best with your business endeavors as well. and we certainly will be watching.